Written in March. That's the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, committed to discovering great poets and printing their verse. Back issues and subscriptions available at poetryfoundation.org. And by Anchor Bay Entertainment with August Osage County, directed by John Wells and starring Meryl Streep and Julia Roberts on Blu-ray and DVD. Engineered by Noah Smith, produced by Joy Biles. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
It's time for Open Journal's Community Spotlight, where listeners like you produce your own program. This airtime is a free service offered to those interested in sharing their knowledge, talent, and passions. This is also a space to audition new programming. Opinions expressed in Open Journal may not reflect the views of the Pacifica Foundation, its staff, board, or volunteers. Information shared on Open Journal should not take the place of appropriate professional consultation. Now it's time for Open Journal's Community Spotlight here on KPFT Houston.
Hi, welcome to Open Journal. We thank you for joining us today. This is Ken Kenegas, the current president of Healthcare for All Texas. I'm a registered nurse, and with me is Dr. Christine Adams, a psychologist in private practice and current board member of Healthcare for All Texas. We try to debunk a myth every show, and the myth that we're debunking today is that we can't afford universal single-payer health care system, and if we try, we'd have to ration care and the quality of health would be inferior. Our guest today is Gerald Friedman, professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. A new study by Professor Friedman shows that a nonprofit single-payer system based on the principles of the Expanded and Improved Medicare for All Act, or H.R. 676, would save $1.8 trillion over the next 10 years and still be able to provide high-quality care for everybody. So we're going to ask for your calls a little later in the show. You can call with questions and comments to 713-526-5738.
With the financing proposed by H.R. 676, we would pay a health care tax based on a progressive taxation, and that tax would replace all the health care costs that we have now, our premiums, our co-pays, our deductibles. So there'll be a combination of some taxes on unearned income and taxes on your wages. So just as a sampling, a household earning $40,000 would pay about $1,200 as your total health care costs per year. A household earning $75,000 a year would pay approximately $2,900. And a household that is earning $250,000 per year would pay approximately just under $15,000 on their wages. How much are you paying now for your health care for everything? And again, we want to pose our question that we're always going to ask you each time. What do you think health insurance companies do for our health care system that cannot be done without them? Keep in mind that every other industrialized country has some form of national health program that strictly limits the role of health insurance companies. So call us with your comments and questions, 713-526-5738.
Hello, Professor Friedman.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being with us today. Could you start with giving our listeners a brief explanation of how single-payer would save billions of dollars each year but still be able to provide quality care to everybody?
Well, the answer is in looking at the enormous waste in the current healthcare finance system that we have in the United States. You start with $200 billion that health insurers spend in administrative costs and profits, advertising, processing bills, and the like. About 15 to 20% of your health insurance premium dollar, depending on whether you're in a group plan or an individual plan, goes to administrative costs. By contrast, Medicare, the federal government's health care system for seniors, pays less than 2% towards administrative costs. If we had a single payer, it would be even less. Plus, you add to that the $200 to $300 billion that we spend as a country on billing and insurance operations in physician offices and hospitals. American hospitals now have more people involved in billing than they have beds. There are more people involved in billing operations than there are nurses in the U.S. healthcare system. Most of these people are, you know, spending their time processing these enormous bills. You know, the first time I said in some place about the more billing people than hospital beds, you know, the next thing I said was, what on earth are these people doing? And people came up to me afterwards and said, have you ever seen a hospital bill? You know, and these things are enormously complicated. Everybody with a different insurance plan, a different insurance product, that's what they call it, pays at different rates. With different copays, and processing all, keeping track of all that for each item that, you know, each pill you take in the hospital, each thing that your doctor does. And it's no accident that they make the process of payment enormously complicated, because the purpose of insurance companies is not to provide health care. It's not to keep people healthy. It's to make profit. And right. The way you make profits in an insurance product like healthcare is by screening out people who are going to need healthcare. They do not. Health insurance companies do not profit from insuring people who get cancer or have HIV or have medical problems. They profit by insuring healthy people who stay healthy, and they spend enormous resources screening potential. Clients, potential customers, screening customers to get rid of people who are going to get sick. You know, and a lot of the health insurance system in the United States and a lot of healthcare finance is organized around trying to make more profit by preventing needy people from getting insurance.
You've also, and I know, sort of analyze and crunch the numbers, and that we would also get a lot of savings from bulk purchasing of drugs. Could you tell us a little more about that?
Oh, this is scandalous. McKinsey Global Institute, you know, a private for-profit consulting firm, one of the leading ones. They actually tried to hire me when I got out of college. But they estimate that drugs outside the United States cost 37% less than the average American pays. And there's evidence for this, because the Veterans Administration, which buys in bulk and negotiates with the drug companies, they pay prices 41% less than the rest of America pays. We pay more for drugs because we buy as individuals, and in different insurance companies basically buy as individuals, so the drug companies are able to drive up prices. When my daughter was with us in Italy this past year, I was on sabbatical in Florence and Rome. You know, she got sick. We went to the hospital, which was free in Italy, and they gave us two prescriptions for her. I, as the father, went off to the drugstore thinking about how much this was going to cost, because I figured I'd never get reimbursed by the insurance company. But that was fine, because the drugs, which would have cost $80 in the United States, cost $16 in Italy, because the Italian government bargains with the drug companies. That's exactly what happens when drugs go off patent. You know, after a couple of years with more competition, for the drug prices for generics are 20% what they were for the non-generic patented drug on which the companies make profits. So basically, you could say under single payer, we would save about $600 billion in the first year. About $200 billion by reduced costs for health insurers' overhead. About $200 billion for reduced costs to physicians and hospitals in lower billing costs. And, well, about $250 billion. And about $150 billion would be saved by lower drug prices.
That would pay for a lot of health care for a lot of people.
Oh, yeah, I estimate that we could insure everybody and without co-pays and deductibles so that people would go to the doctor more often when they needed to. And that greater utilization by the uninsured and by the insured would come to about $400 billion. So we would walk away saving $200 billion while getting better health care for all Americans.
You're listening to KPFT 90.1. It's currently 9:40. I'm Ken Kenegas with Dr. Christine Adams. This is Open Journal, and we're talking about how a single-payer system would save billions each year. Our guest is Professor Gerald Friedman. We want to remind you to mark your calendars for the Everybody Institute, May 17th at St. Stephen's Episcopal Church at 1800 Sol Ross. Texas Healthcare for All Texas and Healthcare Now will present a full day of workshops to share knowledge and develop actions with the aim of making healthcare a human right. Go to hcfat.org to register.
Professor Friedman, I know that I had listened to an interview with you a while back, and you had talked about also savings in administration, I think, just also from a patient point of view in terms of duplication of services because of lost records. Could you say a little more about how there would be savings administratively in terms of health care for patients?
Well, patients would be able to, I'm not even counting in these savings estimates the savings that individual patients would get from not having to go through the whole billing operation. I have, spreadsheets on my computer tracking, we're not a particularly unhealthy family, but, we do run up bills, and, so you have to keep track of them. Also, the insurance companies profit from this. It's a scandal how they lose bills. In Maryland, around 1999, there was a merger of two insurance companies. Aetna was buying up somebody else. And the Attorney General allowed this merger on condition that the Attorney General was able to do an audit of that insurer's records. And what they found is they were throwing away about 20% of perfectly clean, legitimate bills. They were just losing them as a deliberate policy. Because if the people refile the bill, then they pay it, and the insurance company keeps the float, the interest on the money that they've held on to for longer. And if people, lose track of it and never file the bill, never file the claim, the insurance company keeps the money. So there are savings to the individual if we reduce the amount of billing activity you have to do. There are also savings to the providers. My family physician, he's a friend, went to college together. He spends 2 to 5 hours a week dealing with the insurance company. That's typical. The typical American physician spends over $80,000 on billing and insurance activities, hiring people to process bills and their own time. The average American physician has somebody working for him or her half-time, 21 hours a week, doing billing and insurance-related activities. That's somebody who isn't doing anything to help people be healthy, nothing to help sick people, but just dealing with the insurance company.
Well, that's certainly been my experience.
Yeah. Plus, it's often very unpleasant activity. It's bad enough to process paper and send bills around, but doctors and practitioners get on the phone to beg insurance companies to allow them to give the type of medication they think the patients need, to allow them to spend more time with the patient, to allow them to do procedures that the doctor, that the trained professional thinks are necessary, but the insurance company, in its great wisdom, decides no. For patients, for the average American, over 25% of Americans last year with insurance, these are people with health insurance, over 25% encountered some cost-related access problem where they did not fill a prescription, they did not have follow-up care, they did not go to a doctor when sick. They had some problem that they did not deal with because the the way we finance health care. Over 60% of people without insurance had some problem like that.
Yeah, I'm sure some of our listeners have. We have a caller, Joe, on the line.
Hey, good morning. I agree with everything you said, and it's very obvious it's going to be better for the patient, it's going to be better for the doctor. However, the most important part of this whole thing, it's going to hurt. That's the insurance company, and they rule this country. So how do we get around that? How do we make this work with the tremendous lobby pressures that we'll see?
It will happen only when we're a democracy, despite the Supreme Court. It will have change when enough Americans get up and demand it and elect politicians who will respond to their needs and not to the pocketbooks of the insurance industry. The only way to do it is the way we've done everything in this country. All the good things that have happened in this country have come because people have demanded it.
This is Open Journal with Ken Kenegas, Dr. Christine Adams, and our guest, Professor Gerald Friedman. We're talking about funding single-payer universal health care. We'll be right back.
And you're listening to Pacifica Radio, KPFT Houston. The time is 9:45. Here's a quick look at traffic and weather. There's an incident on North Sam Houston Tollway eastbound at Hardy Toll Road. Accident involving three vehicles, and the left lane is affected. And also on 59 Southwest Freeway inbound at Newcastle, there is a two-vehicle accident there where the center lane is affected. The current temperature is 62 degrees. Skies are clear. Humidity is 48%. And today is expected to be sunny with a high of 78 and a low of 55 degrees. Please stay tuned after the community spotlight for Bird Note, followed by Wide Open Spaces at 10 o'clock and then SOS Radio at 1 o'clock. And now back to the community spotlight. Today's program, Healthcare Rights.
Another reminder, the Houston chapter of Healthcare for All Texas meets on the second Thursday of each month. That's tomorrow night. At St. Paul's United Methodist Church, 5501 Main Street in the Jones Building, which is not the main sanctuary building. And we're on the second floor in the Fondren Lounge. We'll be there from 6:30 till 8:30. Please join us. I want to thank Joe for his question. We're back with Professor Friedman. Give us a call with more questions at 713-526-5738.
Professor Friedman, could you tell our listeners a little bit about sort of the nuts and bolts, how the structure, the financial structure for the taxing would work for single payer under H.R. 676?
Well, the payment structure, first of all, what people would encounter would be you'd have a card, you bring it into your physician, they swipe it through a card reader or whatever, and type in, you know, the activity. And the bill, you know, and that would go to the Central Social Security or whatever in Washington, and a check would be cut and sent to the provider. You know, end of story. For the consumer, on the other end, you would be paying something in taxes. Instead of paying insurance premiums, and instead of your employer paying insurance premiums, you would be paying an additional you know, income tax set to your payroll, so about 8% of your payroll, your wages would go off to pay for this, just as you pay for Social Security and Medicare now through your payroll through payroll deductions. Your employer would be paying 6%; you would be paying 2% of your wages, and on your federal income tax at the end of the year, you would be paying something out of your interest, rents, profits, and capital gains. Also, Wall Street investors would be paying a tax on every financial transaction. This is something that's done in the United Kingdom. It's going to be introduced in the European community at large. A tax every time you trade a stock, every time you trade a bond, every time you deal with stock options, there'd be a tax paid. The result would be of these three types of taxes would be very, very rich people would pay a lot more because they have the capital gains, they engage in stock transactions. I mean, they're the ones who would be paying a lot more in taxes. The average working American would be paying a little bit more in taxes and a lot less out of pocket and for insurance premiums. So overall, Americans who earn below the 95th percentile, that is Americans who earn basically less than $200,000, would be saving money through this transition.
And getting guaranteed health care from birth to death, basically.
That's right. That's right. In addition to getting better health care, getting rid of the stress and anxiety of the current system, in addition to having the option of quitting a job and not losing your health insurance.
Absolutely.
You know, in addition to that, you'd also be saving a lot of money.
We have some callers. Johnny, you have a question?
Yes, sir. I'm going to be optimistic for the moment and assume that we are headed towards a universal health care system finally, especially after I'm hearing some Republicans lately talk that way, giving some positive indicators. So here's my twofold question. Has there been any thought given to how we prevent people who are in the healthcare insurance industry now from taking the information they have access to about individuals and profiting from that, prohibiting them with maybe criminal sanction if they do that, and also for the people that work in billing to train them to go into actual healthcare if they so choose? Well, is there any funding set aside for that?
The second part, there is funding set aside in H.R. 676, the single-payer bill in Washington.
I'll hang up.
For transition assistance, extended unemployment, and retraining. Because we're talking about 2 million people or so who will be losing their jobs and billing and insurance activities. So we want to help them.
Right.
And there'll be more need because there'll be more people getting health care. So they can, you know, transition naturally. The first part about the privacy thing, there are laws about that which I think are just kind of paper. You know, they're not executed. And you get, everybody here gets ads that are clearly targeted to various healthcare activities that you've engaged in. One of the most profitable activities for the health insurance industry is using the data that they collect. And we've all been given these long, complicated, single-spaced forms to sign while you're lying on a hospital gurney. To release the information to the our private health information to the insurance company.
So that would seem like another good reason to eliminate these for-profit health insurance companies. I think we have another caller, Brad.
Yes, I'm sort of pessimistic about it because Medicare is underfunded, has a debt, Social Security is going to be having a debt. There's never, name me one government project that's ever come on budget. I just do not believe the money's going to be there. In 15, 20 years, we're just going to have a big problem, and we're going to probably have to raise taxes or do something, okay? So I just don't think, I think you're being a little bit too optimistic that this is going to be the cure-all, the end-all.
Well, the budget issues, first of all, are not restricted to the public sector here. The biggest increases in health care costs are in the privately funded part. If our health expenditures had grown at the rate that they've increased within the Medicare system, we'd be doing much better than we are. The difference, the problem, the great growth of our health care expenditure has been in the privately funded part because the insurance companies have been the ones running up all the excess administrative costs and out-of-control spending. As for the budget situation, if we make this transition and if we install the taxes that we're talking about, the H.R. 676, it will actually lower the federal deficit over the next decade by about $2 trillion. It basically would eliminate the federal deficit over the next 10 years.
Plus, I do think if everybody is in the same system, everyone is on the same team trying to make sure it's cost-effective without short shrift to our quality of care. But everyone has to be affected by those decisions for that to work well.
We're live on KPFT 90.1. This is Open Journal with Ken Kenegas, Dr. Christine Adams, and our guest, Professor Gerald Friedman. We're talking about funding for single-payer universal health care. We've got another caller on the line, Diane.
Hello.
Hi. What's
Hi.
Your question?
Actually, it's more of a kind of slash comment. One of the actual benefits that people don't realize that by having this health care for all is there's a lot of people who cannot leave their jobs because they have to have the insurance and they can't afford to start their own companies or start a new business. A lot of small businesses cannot hire the right people because they can't offer the same insurance that big corporations can.
Right.
And just think of the small business growth potential if our insurance was not tied to our jobs.
Exactly.
We could go where we truly thrive.
That's exactly.
Absolutely.
Labor economists talk about what's called job lock, where people are locked into their jobs.
Exactly.
Jobs that they don't like, that aren't good for them. And small businesses especially are afflicted with the enormous cost of dealing with the insurance industry. American businesses spend over $30 billion a year hiring consultants to help them get health insurance.
Mm-hmm.
And small businesses, if one person is working for the company or some family member gets sick, then it can drive the drive up the insurance costs the next year.
Exactly. I had a small company that tried to let somebody go because she was diagnosed for cancer.
Yep.
They couldn't do it, of course, but it was going to drive up their costs for the small company.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I have a friend whose wife got tongue cancer, and he ran a small car dealership. German cars and repairs and things, and their insurance rates soared. And he looked at his fellow at his workers like, "You guys are going to be paying for my wife's cancer."
Well, I think we are coming to the end of our time here, unfortunately, and we could go on talking for quite a while. Thank you very much, Professor Friedman, for being with us and sharing all your knowledge about this topic. And we'll be back next month. I think we're going to be on a different week because of the fund drive, but we'll see you then.
You have been listening to Open Journal, KPFT's experiment in community-inspired radio. Since 1970, KPFT has been a unique source on the Houston airwaves. We rely on listener donations. Visit kpft.org to support this station. KPFT listener members are welcome to produce an Open Journal. Prospective producers must fill out an Open Journal request form, which is available at our website with details. The program director welcomes your feedback on every Open Journal. Listener feedback helps KPFT determine what Open Journals are appreciated by the community at large. To get in touch with the program director, send an email to pd@kpft.org or call 713-526-4000, extension 308. Please stay tuned for Wide Open Spaces coming up at 10, and thank you for tuning in to today's Open Journal here on 90.1 KPFT Houston, Radio for Peace.
Is Bird Note. It's basic black with an inelegant voice. It nests in places we rarely visit, and in relative obscurity, the rusty blackbird has suffered one of the most dramatic population declines ever recorded among our songbirds. Rusties breed in bogs, swamps, and other wetlands across Canada, and just barely into the northeastern U.S. We mostly encounter them northbound during March and April, and southbound in fall, but we're seeing far fewer. During half a century, as bald eagles and peregrine falcons recovered, rusty blackbird numbers plunged by an estimated 90%. Loss of swamps in the southeastern U.S., where they winter, probably explains part of the decline. Other causes might include mercury poisoning and the warming and drying of wetland breeding sites. It's also likely that we overlooked their decline. Blackbirds are generally abundant and resilient. they don't get the same attention we devote to gutsy falcons or vibrant warblers. But the International Rusty Blackbird Working Group, a coalition of biologists and conservationists, is recruiting birdwatchers to track these songbirds during the Rusty Blackbird Spring Migration Blitz. It's happening right now. If you'd like to help the Rusties recover, begin at birdnote.org.